You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, that have given me permission to do these recordings and are the sole publishers of Steiner into English. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 313 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing, the Second Medical Course Given to Doctors. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 16th of April, 1921. Yesterday I said that we would direct our thoughts to elucidating the nature of the medicines we have proposed here, and that for this purpose we would try to shape the whole context of these observations. First, though, I would like to note something that may point you to the various methodological aspects. Very often, through imaginative observation of a particular pathology or any general syndrome, we can acquire direct, intuitive knowledge of the respective medicine. And then, as is quite natural, we may be tempted to reflect on this by drawing on prior judgments available to us as external scientific knowledge. In doing so, we will find that this is mistaken, that we can't do it like that. This is a very common circumstance, which anyone who can undertake esoteric research of any kind, not just in relation to therapy, will come upon frequently. Only by careful pondering, by tracing these things further, do we then find how correct our findings may be. What emerges in research, drawing on the imaginative faculty, followed by use of intuition, will always be the correct finding, as long as it is based, of course, on good powers of cognition. But our judging capacity must always, as it were, find the right momentum, swing itself up to what we perceive in this way. Here we do have to familiarize ourselves with the extremely complex nature of this human organism, which a rational overview finds the greatest conceivable difficulties in grasping, especially when trying to relate this human organism to the external world once again. This strikes us particularly if we take a somewhat more rigorous view of a circumstance I mentioned in these lectures, the function of nitrogen in the human organism. As we saw, there is more nitrogen in exhaled than in inhaled air, and materialistic thinking can really only deal with this by saying that the difference is of no significance. This is because a materialistic view of the human being basically cannot show what the function of nitrogen is at all. This only dawns on us if we consider the following. You know, of course, that there are all kinds of different theories of nutrition, and that in interpreting their findings, researchers take up diametrically opposed positions as to the real function in the human organism of protein ingested in food. Why does the human organism need protein? When addressing this problem, I would say that scientists adopt diametrically opposite points of view. Some say that the whole structure of human protein organisms is constant, that, therefore, something constant or relatively so exists here, and that ingested protein undergoes rapid breakdown and really has little significance for the synthesizing formative capacities of the protein in the human organism. Others, by contrast, assert something regarded as rather outmoded today, that the protein in us is continually broken down and continually recomposed from the ingested protein. Neither of these two theories, which surface in the most diverse forms, and which represent a kind of diametric opposition, are a true picture of what actually occurs. This is because they both regard protein simply as protein, without taking account of the whole human organism. In this human organism, we find a contrast, firstly, between head development, thus the development of nerves and senses, and development arising from the system of limbs and metabolism. There is a diametric contrast here in human nature, which it is vital to consider. The graduated structure of the human being, so important for therapeutic considerations, cannot be understood at all without taking this into account. For instance, we certainly won't be able to understand how the lungs behave in the whole human organism without starting from the following research question. In relation to the head organism, certain forces are doubtless predominant. Then we have the chest organism containing the lungs. The lungs are organs which likewise bear the head forces within them, though more weakly, less intensively, since the same forces pervade the entire human organism in the most varied intensities. And if we now investigate how the eye, astral body, and etheric body work on the whole plastic forming and also unforming of the organs, we find paradoxically that what forms the lungs is a less intensive version of what forms the head. That the lungs are a metamorphosis of the head configuration, but have just remained behind at an earlier stage. The head progresses further in respect of these same formative forces present in the lungs, which stay behind at an earlier level. The lungs are a metamorphosis of the head configuration, and by virtue of being an earlier metamorphosis of the head, are suited to their breathing functions. If, however, the same forces that have remained at an earlier stage in the lungs and suited for respiration advance so that the lungs grow ever more head-like, then they begin to absorb thought forces, the organic forces of thought. In other words, they seek to become an organ of thinking. By trying to do this, by trying too strongly to absorb the forces rightfully located in the head, they acquire a tendency to develop tuberculosis. We can only understand tuberculosis in the context of the whole human being. We have to see it as indicative of breathing's aspiration to start thinking. The breathing is, in fact, metamorphosed in the head, and all thinking functions, through to the assimilation of perceptions, are nothing other than breathing configured in an upward, forward-evolving direction. The head is a more advanced breathing organ, which has progressed beyond the scope of the lungs. It simply holds back breathing, and in place of air intake through breathing, replaces it with intake of etheric forces through the senses. Sensory perception is nothing other than a refined breathing process, that is, one taken into the etheric realm. The head breathes, and the lungs breathe. But something else, the liver, also breathes in us at a still lower level of this metamorphic development. The liver is an incomplete lung, an incomplete head form, and also breathes. Here, though, the polar metamorphosis to sensory activity predominates, the absorption and assimilation of nutrients. This is why the development of lungs and liver development occupies a middle position between stomach development on the one hand and brain and head development on the other. If you take these ideas as your foundation, you will soon come close to seeing the human organs, certain human organs as such, as basically respiratory organs. All the human organs, configured like the brain, lungs, and liver, are at the same time organs of respiration. As respiratory organs, however, they have the urge to breathe into their surroundings. They, therefore, excrete carbon dioxide. This excretion of carbon dioxide is the chief aspect of breathing. They absorb oxygen, and this absorption of oxygen and expelling of carbon dioxide is something not only the lung does, but is also true of the whole organism, of every organ. It is largely an activity of the astral body, which unfolds its dynamic in sympathy and antipathy. Sympathy corresponds to the capacity of inhalation, while antipathy corresponds to the astral body's capacity to exhale. In my book, titled Theosophy, you can find a description of the astral body as permeated by forces of antipathy and sympathy. The astral body works in respiration as antipathy and sympathy throughout the human being, and we must regard this as the astral body's inner activity. And here, we come to the final point of these observations, which tells us that the proteins generally present in us, inasmuch as they belong to organs such as those described, are predisposed to respiration and come to outward expression through breathing. Yet everything that comes to outward expression also expresses itself inwardly. Let me draw this schematically. A protein-containing organ in you, belonging to this organic group I have described, expresses itself outwardly by developing respiratory activity, see figure 13. But by breathing outwardly, see also plate 5, it develops another inner activity, polar opposite to breathing, that of spirit release, of soul release. A soul-releasing activity. By breathing outward, developing breathing in an outward direction, you develop an inward activity in soul and spirit, which of course needs no space to unfold. On the contrary, you could say it continually vanishes into space, disappearing from three-dimensional space. But this activity manifests inwardly, in an inward direction, and it is largely due to the property of human protein that it does so. What functions as inner activity in the head is introduced through the senses from without. This is why the head organs contain least spirit. They absorb the spirit from the external world by acquiring it through the senses. The head is the human being's least spiritual organ. By contrast, human spirituality, specifically initiated in the body, in the development of spirit within, of real, not abstract spirit, starts in the lung system and works from without inward, in a contrary direction to breathing. And the most spiritual organs are those belonging to the liver system. They develop the greatest spiritual activity in an inward direction. This can also tell us why head-focused people become materialistic. Since the head can only assimilate external spirituality, they are misled into believing that everything of a mental or spiritual nature is absorbed from the external sensory world. A full-blown intellectual will therefore always also be a materialist. The more of a thinker one is, a head thinker, the more one will tend to become a materialist. If we wrestle our way through to insight with our whole being, on the other hand, starting to become aware of how we think as a totality, with organs lying further back, then materialism ceases to find affirmation in our consciousness. The activity which comes to expression in breathing is also apparent externally in the elimination of carbon as carbon dioxide. But the accompanying activity of spiritualization, which unfolds in an inward direction, is connected with nitrogen. Once the nitrogen is expended, it is expelled, you see, for the purpose of spiritualization. The degree to which nitrogen is expelled is a measure of how much our organs are working inwardly toward spiritualization. From this you can gather that someone who does not credit the existence of spirituality will inevitably remain in the dark about the uptake of nitrogen in the human organism. Only once we know that both an inward and outward-directed activity unfolds every time protein is formed or configured, can we understand the role of nutrition. If you examine this process, which is fundamentally a process of respiration with its polar contrasts, you can see that nutrition and digestion border everywhere on processes of respiration. Wherever nutrition and digestion are at work, breathing and spiritualizing processes come toward them. In this spiritualizing process, thus in the other aspect of breathing, we find shaping and modeling forces at work in protein formation, everything that gives us form. And then you can also understand the following. This activity also very much indicates a reciprocal interplay of the astral body and the ether body. The astral body works in our breathing through sympathy and antipathy, while the etheric body's activity comes up against the astral body's sympathies and antipathies. Everywhere in the human organism, the ether body and its activities encounter respiration. The ether's actions engage in us predominantly in our fluid parts. We are at least 2/3 water, of course. In this aqueous organism, where the etheric body is primarily active, the ether forces manifest physically. In the other organism, a gaseous one, implanted into us from the atmosphere, the forces of respiration come to expression. And so we can also regard what occurs between astral body and etheric body as a reciprocal interplay between water forces and air forces. This interplay of water and air forces continually takes place in us. Neither, of course, is entirely suppressed by the other. This is why we always inhale traces of water vapor with the air, so that ether quality also crosses over into the breathing aspect. Likewise, respiratory activity crosses over into intrinsic organs of digestion and nutrition. Insofar as they are also formed of protein, they too breathe. You see, one aspect always crosses over into the other, so that one or the other activity always predominates in any particular organ. We can never describe these things in a one-sided way. If we regard a particular organ, say the lungs, as dedicated solely to respiration, we are mistaken. The other activity is always also present, although to a lesser extent. Nutrition primarily occurs through an activity developing in etheric fluidity and physical solidity. In other words, the primary aspect of nutritional and digestive activity is accomplished in a fluid, etheric, and solid physical realm, while the primary aspect of breathing activity occurs in the gaseous realm, and the primary aspect of eye activity, intrinsically spiritual activity, unfolds in diverse states of temperature in relation, of course, with this same eye. In the physical organism, spiritual activity embodies an interaction of the eye with states of temperature, with all those systems where warmth can work into the physical body. The eye must always be allied with warmth, and its activity always proceeds from warmth. If we put a patient to bed and cover him with a blanket, this means nothing other than inviting the eye to make suitable use of the increase in warmth thus achieved. At the same time, this highlights human nutrition in general. This is an interaction between tissue fluids, the aqueous domain, in which nutrition and elimination primarily occur, and our actual protein organism. The latter remains relatively stable or constant, only fluctuating as we grow and then becoming more stable, and at most undergoing a kind of depletion in the second half of life. In tissue fluid, a continual absorption and breakdown of the protein contained in food occurs. And in this activity lie the attacks carried out on what seeks to remain a stable factor in protein synthesis, the internal protein organs themselves. They wish to remain stable because they seek to inwardly secrete or release soul spiritual activity. What is accomplished in the process of nutrition is really based on this constant interaction between lively uptake and destruction of proteins, and the play of forces that is seeking rest, an extraordinarily dynamic interplay in the protein within us. It is therefore partly a superstition, though it also contains some truth, to say we are built up from the food we ingest. It is superstition because the constructive forces are already present in us through the very fact of being human, are contained in our proteins. And because, on the other hand, we unfold an activity from the other pole that is really an ongoing attack on the stability of our own protein configuration. And so it is not true to say that intake of nutrients sustains human life. It simply isn't true. For it is equally true to say that life is sustained by ensuring the living interplay of forces in tissue fluid. If, therefore, you prepare dishes that stimulate this activity in tissue fluid, then you are sustaining life. You are not doing so, however, by administering nutrients to the body, but instead by exerting an impact on the stable forces of the body's proteins. The process you stimulate through intake of food embodies the most primary factor in sustaining life, so that here, too, we must focus on the process. For instance, substances we know to be very beneficial in children may well have no effect in adults. This is because the child is involved in formative growth and weight increase, and therefore needs intake of substances, needs them to enter him and unfold their forces inwardly. If a particular substance has a good effect in a child, this does not, by any means, signify that it will work in an adult in the same way. In an adult, it may well be far more important simply to sustain the repose-seeking forces in his tissue fluid by activating an appropriate stimulus. If we now turn from everything that develops in the backward-oriented human organs, in the lungs and liver, the head is of course also backward-oriented, to consider organs that are more embedded in tissue fluid, in this activity, then we come to the heart, enclosed by the lungs as archetype of these. This human heart is formed entirely out of the activity of tissue fluid, and its activity is nothing other than a reflection of the inner activity of tissue fluid. The heart is not a pump, as I have often remarked, but is more what I would call an instrument for reading or monitoring the activity of tissue fluid. The pumping actions of the heart do not cause blood circulation, but the circulation, rather, gives the heart its impetus. The heart has as little to do with the circulatory function in us as the thermometer has, to do with producing external heat or cold. Just as a thermometer is nothing other than an instrument for recording heat and cold, so the heart is an instrument for recording our circulation and what flows into it from the blood's metabolic system. Here we have a golden rule we must faithfully observe if we wish to understand the human being. The modern scientific belief that the heart is a pump that drives blood through the blood vessels is the opposite of the truth. Those who subscribe to the heart as pump belief should, if they wish to be consistent, also declare their faith in the capacity of a thermometer to raise the temperature in a room. These two things are really one and the same. So you see the consequences of an outlook that ignores, by far, the most important aspect of the human being, the spirit and soul. It overlooks the motion-impelling, dynamic force in us, and instead bases everything on mere substance. This outlook seeks to derive from matter the forces which are really impressed upon it. It tries to impose on the heart capacities which, in fact, it only acquires through the dynamic play of forces informing it. And so we can say that the opposite of respiration and the release of spirit in us is embodied in the most advanced and highly organized form in heart activity and the organ of the heart. Here we find what can be called the polar metamorphosis to mere reconfiguration. If we examine the head, lung, and liver, we find various stages of reconfiguring metamorphosis. But as soon as we consider the heart in relation to the lungs, we have to speak of a polar metamorphosis. In other words, of the fact that the form of the heart is polar opposite to the lungs. And all the organs which develop in a more anterior position, including in most exemplary form the female uterus, are in turn reconfigured stages of cardiac development. I refer to the female uterus since there is also a male uterus, but this is only present as ether body in the man. The uterus is nothing other than a reconfigured heart. This approach is the starting point for developing insight into the human organization. Now, the fats and carbohydrates are what engage with this other activity, which you can say has its center or comes to rest in the motions of the heart. This is where these fats and carbohydrates exert their action. Of course, this extends over the whole body, for just as the whole body breathes and develops spirit, so on the other hand, it also deposits substance and elaborates functional systems of forces geared to combustion. This can cast a certain light, and at the same time illustrate how we always pass from true inner observation of the human organism to therapeutic considerations, on the condition that used to be called consumption and has only acquired other names based on theoretical thinking. The condition involves the fact that diverse influences contributing to this disorder, all basically the same in nature, divert the human being from a cosmic sphere and push him toward the earthly, to life in poor dwellings, and so forth. All the accounts we have relating to consumption or tuberculosis can be summed up as symptomatic of the fact that people are diverted away from the sun and the cosmos and impelled to lead a life that separates them from sun and cosmos. Thus they lose their joy in cosmic influences, consisting largely in absorption and perception via the senses. In such a person, this joy is dulled so that his soul, his whole sensibility, may not permeate the senses, and in consequence descends into the lungs which then seek to become an organ of thinking, to become head. So that their outer form also clearly shows this tendency. The form assumed by the lungs in this disorder shows us that the forces which ossify the human head are coming to expression there, giving rise to indurations of the lung and such like. What must we do, therefore, if we wish to counteract this condition? To combat the lung's tendency to become head, we must consider, first and foremost, that this points to a slackening of the necessary astral activity and to excessive eye activity. In other words, eye activity starts to overcome astral activity. This must be remedied. All external sensory impressions stimulate eye activity in particular. And assimilation of sensory stimulus continues its way inward throughout the human organism and culminates in salt deposits. These deposits are not properly regulated in someone with a tendency to consumption. We must therefore offer support here and try to counteract what the lungs are no longer capable of by administering highly concentrated external applications of salt. Salt rubs applied externally will counteract the processes of induration that develop from within outward. Externally applied salt rubs must naturally also be enhanced in their effect by efforts to induce the inner organism to absorb and accept what is trying to enter from without. One can also prescribe salt baths, highly concentrated salt baths, but one still has to induce the organism to really engage with this inwardly, or in other words, respond to it from within. Here you can weigh up the following, which partly follows from what we discussed last year. To stimulate the organism to develop from within an activity that responds to and regulates certain external organizing forces, we need to administer small doses, tending toward homeopathic dilutions, of mercury. In this respect, mercury is an important medicine, an important regulator. General dosage guidelines will be particularly applicable here. To sum up what I have said previously, the system of metabolism and limbs is the one that most closely resembles external nature. If this system lacks something, and we need to intervene here, we have to use the low potencies. As soon as we come to the middle system, medium potencies are needed. And when we wish to work from the head, or as soon as we wish to work from what is connected with the activity of the spirit in the head, we need the higher potencies. In this case, since we are concerned with the activity of the lungs, this is part of our middle system, and the mercury potency must be a medium one. Wherever we count particularly on a medicine that works on the head organization, and from there back through the whole organism, the highest potencies are required, and these will be especially beneficial wherever we decide that silicone compounds are called for. By their very nature, silicone compounds require the highest dilution because they always gravitate toward the head and the body's periphery, which also belongs to the head system. In calcium compounds, on the other hand, when use of these is called for due to other reasons, we will almost invariably be right to stop short of the highest potencies and instead use the low potencies. To sum up, a rule of thumb for potentizing is whether we need to intervene in the system of limbs and metabolism, the middle rhythmic organization, or the head organism. In the latter case, though, we must of course also remember that the head organism in turn sends strength through the whole organism from the other direction. One can, for example, discover that a foot complaint is really a head disorder in disguise and originates in the head. then we should not try to cure it by addressing the metabolism, but rather the head. Here we can use high potencies of a substance which might be good in low potencies if it were a matter of inducing a curative effect originating in the metabolism. These things all certainly have a rationale, which must gradually be discovered. We will only proceed properly here if we engage in careful and precise observations of the outcome of our research, but the ways we should proceed must be sought as outlined here. It is also important to remember that no one is entitled to speak about specific cures unless he really, carefully, compiles and remembers what his experiences have taught him. For every single such experience is, of course, also instructive and bears fruit for subsequent cases. Now, if you take account of what I have said here, you will find that it no longer seems nearly so mysterious if a disorder affects both brain and liver simultaneously. The liver is just a metamorphosed brain. If we find simultaneous liver degeneration and deterioration of the brain ganglia, these two conditions lie in precisely the same direction. Here we find, in fact, a form of disease intensified in comparison to what causes tuberculosis. It is merely an intensified metamorphosis of tuberculosis. In this case, therefore, we need to administer mercury in a less dilute form and as external application rather than external applications and baths using ordinary sodium salt, common salt. We will need to resort to calcium salts. You will gather that possible sources of error lie in wait everywhere, and that we can really only discover the right course of action by observing the human organism from within outward. Someone, for instance, might easily come along and say that a particular disorder can be cured with mercury, and this treatment will achieve some effect or other. But the disorder in question is by no means inevitably connected with syphilis. And if the person in question imagines that anything cured with mercury must be connected with syphilis, he may well be mistaken. In the same way, you will now understand the things a bit better which I said when talking about, quote, mental disorders, close quote, last year. When I spoke of softening of the brain several days ago, I was, of course, referring to paralytic disorders. But the term paralysis is somewhat vague. There is always a sense that one is referring to an externally manifesting syndrome. But now, of course, we have to ask what I meant by saying last year that the real causes of psychological disorders must be sought in organ deformities. This is indeed true, and is true to such a degree that considering symptoms of mental disorder alone will not lead to any useful outcome. Nothing much will result. One can actually say that very similar psychological complexes can be traced back to very different causes. In so-called mentally ill patients, we always need to look for an organ deformity, some organ or other that is not functioning properly, and then we must ask why it isn't functioning. We will find it is because forces of stable protein synthesis, not the variable but the stable forces, have become defective. So there is something in the patient that continually seeks to destroy the original shape and structure of a particular organ. And for this reason, it does no good to focus too much on what is happening in the tissue fluids, and of course represents the other pole of metabolism. Thus, in starting from the symptoms, we won't get anywhere with what intrinsically belongs to metabolism. On the other hand, it will be extraordinarily important to seek insight into mental illnesses in eliminated substances. This will give us important reference points. It is extremely important to study the nature of eliminations in someone with mental illness. Last year I said that certain types of mental illness present as a compulsion to form imaginations and inspirations, and this is indeed what inner release of spirit signifies. If this kind of compulsion is present, this is basically because the organ has become damaged. If the organ is not defective but normally constituted, it does indeed develop imaginative capacity, but this remains unconscious. Once it has been damaged, it is no longer able to develop imagination properly. On the one hand, the organ is defective, and in consequence a compulsion to develop imagination arises. And on the other, the imagination remains unsecured by the organ, and therefore appears as hallucination, and so forth. We can see it like this. If we have an organ, and the imaginations developing within it, see figure 14 below, which then radiate into the rest of the human organism, and are perceived. Then, if the organ is deformed, the developing imagination cannot unfold properly in its plasticity, and thus being abnormal, it impresses itself on conscious awareness. Then we find the patient has hallucinations and visions. On the other hand, the organ is not functioning properly. And this gives rise to the urgent desire for real imaginations. Such things become clear simply by gaining an insight in this way into their inner nature. We will end here and listen to Dr. Scheidegger's lecture. When we reconvene, we will address the questions that have been asked and also explain more about our medicines. The end of Lecture 6.